Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We are just days away from the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of its smaller neighbor, Ukraine. February 24th, 2022 marked the start of the biggest air, sea, and ground assault in Europe since the Second World War. Just before the invasion, Ukrainian President Zelensky warned Russia that the consequences would be, quote, an abundance of pain, filth, blood, and death. He went on, this calamity carries a huge cost in every meaning of this word, the Ukrainian president said. Every hour of every day since has proven those words to be right. Cataclysmic for Ukraine, course-changing for Russia, history-shaping for the wider world. Earlier today, you heard in our news, our U.S. Senate passed a $95 billion foreign aid bill, $60 billion of it assistance for Ukraine. This sets up a showdown with the House. As the Speaker of the U.S. House, Mike Johnson, has criticized the legislation, 22 Senate Republicans, including Iowa's U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, bucked a majority of their party and former President Trump in joining Democrats to approve this military assistance. This hour, we put politics of the conflict mostly to the side, though they inevitably enter our conversation, to have writers reflect on 2 years of war in Ukraine. In just a few moments, we'll be joined by Ukrainian writers Askold Melmichek. Also, we hope to have Oksana Lutsishina. Let's start with world traveler, war correspondent, memoirist, poet Christopher Merrill. For more than 20 years, Chris has directed the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. In that capacity, he has engaged in numerous missions of cultural diplomacy around the world, including many in war-torn countries, including to Ukraine several times, going back decades. He's the author of the new book, On the Road to Lviv. Christopher Merrill usually joins me in the Iowa City studio of IPR. Today, I believe, from Mexico, where he's teaching for a couple of weeks. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Ben. And I am indeed in Mexico. It's very warm here.
All right. You're reading at an event, and people can see you at an event at Prairie Lights coming up on Tuesday, February 27th, together with Christopher Bolin. I want to mention that. You'll be back for that. And Chris, before I ask you to share from your book a little bit and talk about the experiences that shaped the poetry in that book, reflect for a moment on this anniversary in a few days, this moment, and what happened nearly 2 years ago.
Well, I take the anniversary quite seriously because it happens also to be my birthday. And 2 years ago, I turned 65 on the same day that the Russian forces launched an extraordinary attack, as you rightly pointed out, the largest attack in Europe since World War II. And what we've seen over these 2 years is an extraordinary amount of loss of life, loss of blood and treasure, the melding together of a coalition in the West to try to oppose authoritarian policies of Vladimir Putin, the head of the Russian Federation. And we've seen writers try to deal with the consequences of this this large-scale disaster. From my perspective, it's something that I feel like I understand because I covered the wars of succession in the former Yugoslavia back in the 1990s and wrote a couple of books about it. And all those same ingredients seem to be operating here, a misguided nationalism on the Russian part. They have vastly superior numbers of soldiers they can throw at Ukraine, but also that grit that the small nations of the world hold out all their hope and find ways to survive that initial onslaught. And in a sort of David and Goliath situation, we come to respect them for what they're trying to do, which is to maintain their country, their traditions, their cultural experience, their literature, in the face of the onslaught from their neighbors, a completely illegal war of aggression that, as we approach the second anniversary, seems not to end.
Yeah. Chris, let's go to your book. I want to have a short quote from it here, being as you're on the phone. Let me just quote from this, because those who follow news here on IPR will remember this. But here you recount Mariupol in a poem, a part of this book. And then I'd like to have you go into how this book of poetry came about. This is from your book, "The Ruined City of Mariupol, where the remaining soldiers cleaned their guns, in the steel plant, counting the detonations, awaiting yet another missile strike, launched to raise their hideout, crushing them under a slab of concrete and rebar. Exhausted men and women who would sleep if only the barbarians stopped shooting long enough to let civilians flee." I'll stop there in this passage, and Chris, and just have you take up the story of this coming together from your multiple experiences, diplomatic missions to Ukraine.
Thank you for that good reading of it, Ben. The fact is that I know something about what the determined citizens and soldiers in Mariupol went through, because I was reporting from the besieged city of Sarajevo during the war in the former Yugoslavia, the longest siege in modern history, and in such circumstances, you are entirely at the mercy of the besiegers, in this case, the Russian Federation forces, and luck. It's sometimes said that what goes on in war is you have long periods of boredom punctuated by moments of terror. In Mariupol, that terror went on and on and on. And so what I'm trying to write about in that place was just what that experience might have been like for the soldiers there who, and as we know, Mariupol was reduced to, it was pretty much leveled. And that's what's happened all too often in this war. As for how the book came about, the program that I run, the International Writing Program, is funded to a considerable degree by the U.S. State Department. And in that capacity, I have gone out from time to time as a cultural envoy. The first mission that I made to Ukraine was in the wake of the Orange Revolution back in 2006. And on a drive west from Kyiv to Lviv, in an unheated van, I was so cold that the only way I could keep my teeth from chattering was to just start to describe what I saw outside my window. So the book began as much as a kind of travelogue about visiting, going to this fabled city of Lviv. And then, of course, I made another mission there right after the Maidan Revolution in 2014, which prompted Putin to invade the Donetsk and Luhansk regions in eastern Ukraine, and then to occupy Crimea. So when we think about the war that we're celebrating, the second anniversary of the invasion, we're 9 years into the Russian invasion beginning in eastern Ukraine.
Yeah. Chris, I hope you have your new book with you. I'll just reintroduce you, and I'd ask you to read a short passage from it. The imagery, so stark, so potent in your work here. Christopher Merrill, my guest, joining us today live from Mexico, where he happens to be teaching, author, essayist, director of the International Writing Program. We'll be joined by Ukrainian writers a little bit later in the program as we mark nearly 2 years since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, this disputed part, and rightly pointed out by Chris, Crimea was invaded and occupied many years before. Chris, give us a passage that we can latch on to here, and I'm sure, more stark imagery of what's been happening.
Sure. Well, I have a little passage where I'm talking about the great Ukrainian poet Taras Yevchenko, and what I seemed to see, what I was seeing there, and this is how the section begins. The sandbags piled around the monument in Kharkiv to Taras Yevchenko, poet and founder of a literature and language the Russian soldiers firing at the city do not believe exists, are testimony to some of the ways in which poetic logic can shape experience for generations, unconsciously surviving in a turn of phrase, a cadence, or an adage passed along in pillow talk and argument between a couple headed for divorce a week before their neighbors went to war against a ghostly nation resurrected in verse, a black cloud hid a cloud of white. That last line is from Shevchenko, and of course the Russians are trying to say that Ukraine doesn't exist. It's not a distinct culture and language, the Ukrainian language, which is not the truth. In fact, these are distinct cultures and languages, and the Ukrainians are fighting to preserve their way of being in the world, their language, their culture, their customs.
Mm-hmm. Chris, we have about a minute before we go to break. What can poetry do in the face of this? What is the role of poetry and poets such as yourself at a time of war?
Well, poets can't do much to change anything, but they can, in the first instance, bear witness to what is going on and to a catastrophe. So the determination to get down faithfully in language that we hope will survive what actually is going on at a particular moment in history. I think that's the best of what poets can do. But they're also laying the groundwork for whatever the future is going to look like, because they have a chance to testify to not only dastardly deeds done by the Russian invaders and occupiers, but also the heroism of the Ukrainian fighters who, against all odds, have managed to hold out for these 2 years, and with any luck and a good vote in the House, or at least a chance to vote in the House, will have the arms to continue to wage this battle.
Christopher Merrill with us. He's director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa, has had many diplomatic missions, cultural missions to Ukraine. We'll be back and be joined by writers from Ukraine. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org. Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
We're back with more River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer, marking nearly 2 years since the start of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, excepting, of course, the invasion of Crimea, which happened back in 2014, the latest invasion on February 24th of 2022. Christopher Merrill with us, joining us from Mexico, where he's teaching for a couple of weeks, director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. Let's invite some others into this conversation. First of all, Askold Melnichak is with us, Ukrainian author, professor of English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Askold, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Thank you very much for having me. And hey, Chris, nice to hear you and that fabulous poem, which it was a privilege to publish.
Yeah. Askold, you have a unique Ukrainian background. Bring us up to speed on that before we have your reflections on this ominous anniversary.
Certainly, Ben. You know, first of all, I would just say that I consider myself a Ukrainian-American writer. I mean, I was born in New Jersey in 1954. And however, my parents were Ukrainian refugees who arrived in the country in 1950 after 5 years in a refugee camp. And, you know, they when they arrived, they fully expected that communism would not endure, the Soviet Union would fall, and they would head back to their homes, which they hated leaving. As we know, that did not happen. But in expectation of it, they raised my sister and myself with Ukrainian as our first language, so that I really didn't learn any English until entering the kindergarten. Not an uncommon thing for refugees and immigrants expecting to return to the homeland. However, once I did learn English, I fell in love with the language and began writing in it early and kind of continued up until now. So that's a kind of very rough outline of the mm-hmm. of the family background.
With parents, refugees, as refugees from Ukraine, and the story you just told us, those refugees, your parents must have thought that authoritarian leaders were on the out. That's what that war was fought for, and now we see during these times the resurgence of all kinds of authoritarian leaders around the world. Reflect on this anniversary to come, Askold.
You're absolutely right, Ben. I mean, it is stunning to us here in this country, and I think probably less so to some of the people in the areas where the authoritarians have surfaced. I know that friends in Ukraine have been warning me about what would be happening or what was already happening in Ukraine back in 2014. And before then, you know, the country has been living under the shadow of Russia for so long and has been invaded by it and has endured despite many prohibitions against the use of the Ukrainian language in the country. For years, really practically for a century, the language was prohibited. Literature was not allowed to be published in it. That began in the 19th century, Ukrainians and again others living under similar circumstances developed a resilience against this sort of authoritarian pressures, and they developed a very powerful civil society, in part because they did not feel they could trust their government to serve their best interests, which is something we saw kind of manifesting most dramatically first in the Orange Revolution and then following that in the Maidan in 2014, when Ukrainians resisted the attempts of their then president Yanukovych to forge a new alliance with Putin and Russia, in exactly because they saw themselves as part of different tradition, a democratic tradition that they associated with the West, with Europe. That has been the focus of their aspirations for as long as I can remember. You know, and I can say that this was true very, very personally at my home. My mother was was an aspiring poet. In fact, I have on my desk a rejection letter written by an editor from Lviv, the city about which Chris wrote. He is saying that they invite her to resubmit her new poems in the fall because they think that she's talented and they would publish them. But the letter is dated August 30th, 1939, right before Hitler invaded World War II began. So the poetry, however, has been so really an important part of the whole sort of process of keeping the language alive, the culture alive, the sense of community among its citizens. It's a terrifying moment right now, because the same sort of pressures and assaults that my parents experienced, which forced them out of their homeland, a whole new generation, which had thought it was free of that, are now living through.
Yeah. Askold, being as this is a reflection by writers on this moment here, I wonder if you have a passage from your writing to share with our listeners.
Thanks, Ben. You know what I'd like to do is share two very short poems that I translated from a Ukrainian poet who was actually here in Boston, where I'm based, in 2007 as part of a fellowship at my university, which is specifically focused on bringing together people from regions under stress and in trouble. And this is by a young poet. She was a young poet in 1930. She was in her 30s in 2007. Mariana Savka. She's one of the country's leading poets and also one of its leading publishers. And I just want to compare a poem that she wrote in 2007 with one that she wrote after the war began. So this first one is called Easter Jazz. Sonny Rollins, mad and bearded like a god with his sax, wild as the wind beating against the door of Symphony Hall, prophesizes that spring still has a chance to bloom, and the mind-loose jazz and my desire and blood blow recklessly through my veins. I go, I dance, I catch the syncopations. Lord of jazz, bless, please, this our Easter. And then you hear in that poem the kind of openness and freshness of youth, welcoming life in all its positive energies. And here's a poem that Mariana wrote, in which I translated almost 2 years ago after the start of the war. It's called My God Spends All Night. My God spends all night forming his battalions, is a crack shot, wages wars. My God forgives my curses as he polishes his stones. My God won't hide behind my back, throws quilted covers over children. My God buys tourniquets, then lines up to give blood. My God can't get a good night's sleep while the entire country's standing guard. My God allows me never to forgive and lets me call things as they are. And I think you hear there very starkly the difference.
Oh, gosh, yes. And just, it really takes your breath away to juxtapose that Sonny Rollins with My God Spends All Night. Chris, step in here and comment on those two poems translated by Askold here, if you could.
Well, first I want to say how beautiful the translations are and how powerful the poems are. What it made me think was what I experienced in Bosnia during the war. The poet Goran Simic, a friend of his, said that his works were quite hermetic before the siege of Sarajevo. And then during the siege, he wrote in such a plain and direct way about the sheer horror of what he and his fellow sufferers were living through. And I think that Askold has exactly caught that experience. When you are facing the abyss, it's time to speak plainly.
Yeah. Askold Melnicek with us, Christopher Merrill with us as well. Let's introduce a third guest into our conversation who has been in the wings, certainly listening to our conversation. Oksana Lutsishina is with us, Ukrainian novelist, poet, assistant professor of Ukrainian studies at the University of Texas in Austin. Oksana, are you there?
Great to be here.
Oksana. Yes, now I think we're hearing you. Oksana, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking time here. Tell us a little bit about your background here and how you came to the U.S., your current connections with your homeland.
Yes, of course. Well, I came here quite a while ago, and I came here to get my advanced degrees and then stayed here teaching. But I have very close ties to Ukraine. My family is still there, of course. They're in the western side of Ukraine, called Transcarpathia. And also my publisher, who actually happens to be Mariana Sauka, whose beautiful poem Askold just read in his translation. So I go back and forth quite a bit, and I, of course, participate in every initiative that I can, either across the ocean or here in the United States. Also in Austin, we have a very big and strong Ukrainian community who's very active in all possible ways, lobbying with politicians and having community events, raising consciousness and informing the population here about what's going on.
Yeah. Oksana, give us a sense, since you mentioned your connections with the Ukrainian community here and your connections with your fellow Ukrainians back in the homeland, what is the mood right now after nearly 2 years since this latest Russian invasion?
I think the mood is everybody understands that this is a very critical moment, a very difficult moment, perhaps a moment of crisis, but I have not heard any defeatist narratives ever from anyone. I think people are still ready to stay strong and to persevere. However, everybody's extremely concerned for many reasons, and how it's going to be now with the world helping us and how it's going to be with us standing up to Russia. But it's such an old conflict, as Oscar mentioned, that it's kind of, it has these two sides. One is, of course, the shock of war, and the other is that this is a very old enemy with whom I think many generations of us knew sooner or later we will be in the open conflict.
Yeah. Oksana, we've been asking you three writers to share writing. I don't know if you had a passage already during your work day. If you don't, please just reflect on the role of writers in this situation.
Well, it's actually a difficult question, more difficult than it would have been in different times, because so many writers in Ukraine right now are actually just in the army. And, you know, that they feel like that's when where they can be most useful. However, I think it, of course, very much depends on where you are, depending on your circumstances. And it's one of those tools of cultural diplomacy that is impossible to overestimate. And I'm thinking about all the wonderful poet friends back home and all the great poets here who really helped us so much along the way and who felt our pain as if it was their own. You know, like we were talking about Christopher Merrill's book On the Road to Lviv, and I read it, and I was amazed at how detailed it was, how he actually saw everything we saw and how he reflected on everything we reflected. So it's not so much the look of an outsider, it's the look of a real witness. So I think that's how poets feel back home, too. It's this job of witnessing. However, Irina Tilik, a Ukrainian poet and very famous filmmaker, once noted that right now in Ukraine, everybody suffers from guilt. Those who are not in the country are feeling guilty because towards those who are in the country. Those who are in the country, guilty towards those who are in the front lines. And those who are in the front lines and alive are feeling guilty towards those who died. So this is one of those destructive elements, of course, that war produces. But what I'm saying is that the role of poet right now is to also work all that out and to kind of be sure that what you are doing is actually necessary and that there are ways to somehow still keep standing and writing and connecting with people and not shut down, because that's what guilt does. It shuts you down.
Yeah. Oksana, and I know all three of you knew her well. I think you were a close friend of, we talk about those lost in this war, Victoria Amalina, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly. Oksana, she was a close friend of yours. Tell us about that friendship and the circumstances that led to her death. I'm so sorry.
Yes, of course. Thank you. Victoria Amalina, yes, she's an amazing person, and it pains me to use this past tense verb on her because I always feel like she's here with us. My friendship with her started about 10 or 12 years ago, actually in New York City, believe it or not, because we were both there on an occasion, and just we never stopped being friends ever since. Victoria, her trajectory is kind of unusual. She was actually a person who had a very successful career in the IT industry. And then at some point, her heart was just overflowing because there were so many events happening. The Revolution of Dignity, the Euromaidan, you know, then annexation of Crimea, then the war in Donbass. And she actually, her family, she had ties to Donbass. So she started writing, and she actually left that career to start writing. And she started with fiction, and then she progressed to poetry and nonfiction. I think life forced her to write poetry. She herself said that she just kind of writes things down on the page as if it was a poem, not prose, and then it just becomes a poem somehow, because such are the circumstances. And she actually was supposed to go to Paris to finish working on her nonfiction book. She was involved with a human rights organization. She was riding around the country collecting testimonies of the victims of Russian occupation. And literally at the last minute before she had to leave Kyiv and go west, she had a children's camp that she was also attending in the Carpathian Mountains. And then Paris, she meets a Colombian delegation of writers and journalists, and she wants to accompany them to the city of Kramatorsk, where, unfortunately, the Russian missile wounds her mortally, and eventually she dies in several days. So it's a huge tragedy for all of us. And she really was one of those people who had so much empathy towards everyone, who managed to give something to her friends. And she had many friends, actually. So a lot of us are grieving and mourning. And I think that's, she will, you know, there will never be another Victoria, and we will always think about her.
Yeah. We have about a minute before we need to take a break. Askold, can I ask you briefly to comment on Victoria? I know you knew her as well.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Yeah, a remarkable person, as Oksana just said, and somebody that I met in here while she was living here with her family in Boston, and attended a reading that I had organized. And our first conversation, I remember, was about her travels through Tibet. She was looking for places to study meditation here in Boston. A very kind of sweet and open-hearted and warm person, as an Irish writer said about her, you know, you meet her and she waltzes right into your heart. You know, so we just became very friendly and exchanged writing and talked about writers we loved. And then through a wonderful kind of coincidence, Christopher, who has brought so many writers together in the course of his storied career, asked Victoria and myself to teach for him. And should I continue this after the break? It sounds like the music.
Yeah,
let's
do that. Yeah, you hear the music. Okay. We'll take a break. Yep. Back with Askold Melmacek and other writers in just a moment. Stay tuned. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
Back with more River to River from IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Witness, a word coming up again and again with our perspectives from three writers, reflecting on nearly two years since the invasion by Russian forces of Ukraine. With us today, Askold Melmacek, Ukrainian-American writer, Oksana Lutsishina, Ukrainian novelist and poet, and Christopher Merrill of the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. When we had to break away, Askold, you were talking about a writer lost in this war, a Russian rocket, if I'm recalling that news from a couple of years ago, hitting a cafe, killing and many and wounding many others. So continue on, Askold.
Yeah, Ben, and if I may, just to offer a little bit of a background, because you and Chris spoke about what the importance of writers might be in a time of war. And I want to just underscore that in Ukraine, writers occupy a singularly important position, in part because of Ukrainian history. And the poet that Christopher mentioned, who surfaces in his poem, Taras Shevchenko, a 19th century poet, who was born in 1814, he was born a serf. His owner recognized his talent and sent him to study art in St. Petersburg, where other artists recognized his gifts both as a painter and as a poet. They bought his freedom, and one of the things he did with that freedom was begin to write poetry in Ukrainian, a language which was prohibited by the Russian Empire at the time. He spent much of his time in jail and in exile. And at the same time, what he did was he wrote about the experience of the people, of the peasants among whom he had been raised. And it was the first time that the people of Ukraine actually saw their lives reflected in writing. And they heard about their lives, and that mattered to them. It helped develop their consciousness, their self-awareness, and their sense of rights. You know, and so that sense of the importance of language and poetry is really singular in Ukraine. You'll find a statue to Taras Shevchenko, a poet, in just about every town and village in the country. So flash forward then into the 1930s, and you see again the ways in which writers appear to be threatening to an authoritarian regime because of their power of witnessing. When Stalin destroys a whole generation of writers, something like 250 writers were lost in the 1930s during what is known as the Executed Renaissance, where the intellectuals and cultural figures of the country were executed or exiled and disappeared. And so it's against this background that writers like Oksana Lutsishina and Victoria Melina and others are working, this awareness that they, as the avatars and speakers and carriers of cultural memory, are likely to be the targets should Russia win. I remember this in part because Victoria Melina, whose story I'm about to finish, at a reading that I had organized with American and Ukrainian writers, including writers like Robert Pinsky, the former poet laureate, and James Wood of The New Yorker. At the end of that reading, Victoria said, asked the audience, this was being done on Zoom, and we had a worldwide audience, and Victoria said, "Stay with Ukraine. Either we win or we will be dead." You know, it's that sense of existential moment that is what is driving, I think, so much of the creative energies of the country. So Victoria, so I was saying that Christopher actually helped me bond with Victoria by inviting both of us to co-teach a class for the via the University of Iowa's International Writing Program for Ukrainian students who were scattered all across the country. Obviously, schools were not functioning at this time in any regular way. And so we met on Zoom over the course of a summer or a month in the summer. And in that time, what was so remarkable about that experience was that Victoria and the students would be meeting with me on Zoom, and I would hear air raid sirens in the background during our class, during our two-hour sessions. And not a single person ever left the session because it was so important for them to connect and communicate. You know, the desire to be seen, the desire to know that you are being witnessed, is, I think, a profound longing on the part of those who are under siege. And it is why the work of cultural emissaries like Christopher and the work that you are doing by highlighting our voices at this moment is so, so important. What people under those circumstances worry most about is what can be done and what is done in the dark. That was Victoria.
Yeah. I want to remind those who may have just joined us, Askold, we have about 10 minutes left of our program. Askold Melnichak, Ukrainian-American writer, Oksana Lutsishina, and Christopher Merrill here. Chris, I haven't had you a moment for you to reflect on Victoria, her life, and because I know this was a meaningful person in your life as well.
Well, Askold very brilliantly talked about what Victoria is all about, and I was so thrilled to have Askold and Victoria teach our class. We called it Crafting the Future in Ukrainian, which actually provided us with a new model for thinking about some of our digital learning classes. But I also then had the good luck to host Victoria and several other Ukrainian writers in a small conference in northeastern Poland, November of 2022, about 7 months before Victoria would tragically lose her life. And what I saw of her during those 5 days we were together was how disarmingly brilliant she is. She had a very dry sense of humor, and she managed to cut through all the cant in just moments. And she was somebody who, one of those writers who reminds us of what it means to be a writer and puts us on the straight and narrow, if you will. She was a kind of moral conscience for so many people thinking about this war.
In the final 10 minutes or so of this conversation, I wanted to just kind of probe all three of you for maybe some stories, images, a conversation you've had, perhaps with Ukrainians, perhaps Ukrainian writers currently in Ukraine. Oksana, you talked about you having so much contact with family and friends in Ukraine. What do our listeners most need to understand about the situation in Ukraine right now, perhaps clearing up misconceptions? What should we hear via you from Ukrainians?
I think we do need to tell people about our history as much as we can, and I'm glad Askol talked a little bit about Taras Shevchenko, who is considered the nation maker. And also that this is not the situation where Ukraine is actually part of Russia and somehow was part of Russia. This is just plain not true. It's a different nation. We want to be seen as such. And we also want the world to make room for us to tell our story. And when I say tell our story, I mean to have all these innate meanings somehow more obvious, you know, when you see artifacts and you think Ukraine, you don't just think, you know, Russia or something else. When you hear a song and you know, okay, it's Ukraine. And actually, a great example would be the Carol of the Bells, which is a song that's based on Ukrainian folk songs and written by Mykola Leontovich, who was killed by the Soviets in 1921. So basically, and we need more of that. We need to put these meanings forth a little bit more so that we are more recognized. And I think this will really help us, and I think help the world too, essentially.
Yeah. Askold, can I return to you and talk about the current isolationism that is in our country right now and really at the foundation of this controversy, this debate over whether Ukraine should receive further financial and military funding? How do you see that? Certainly understandable when you look around our country that we have multitudes of problems to solve here. Why should Ukraine receive so much aid in your view? How do you view this debate?
Thank you, Ben. An important question. And I think it's by recognizing that it's one common problem, the problems that we have here in this country and the problems that Ukrainians are experiencing, in fact, share many aspects. But first, I want to begin with a shout out and thank you to your two senators, Charles Grassley and Joni Ernst, for voting to support the aid bill that has just been passed by the Senate. And I'm certainly hoping that your representatives, Marionette Miller-Meeks and Ashley Hinson and Randy Feenstra and Zach Nunn, take a cue from their senior colleagues in the Senate. Because without the sort of support that the U.S. has offered, I'm afraid that Europe will not be able to do enough to support Ukraine in its resistance. Now, what is at stake here is, first of all, a whole system of values. If there is something that we consider singular about democracy, it is the encouragement that it offers for a plurality of voices and opinions to rise up and in vigorous debate and find some kind of common ground through which to forge an identity based not on race and ethnicity or religion, but on common values. That is, I think, what the American ideal has been, and it's the ideal to which Ukraine is aspiring. Only consider what it is asking for. It is asking to become part of Europe. Europe has been the U.S., our country's ally for, it is where, it is the part of the world that hatched this country. And it is a part of the world to which so much of this country is connected. That is what Ukraine is longing for and aspiring to, and has demonstrated its capacity for embodying value, democratic values. It is for that, for individual freedom and a sense of hope for the future in every way. The kind of environmental concerns that are prevalent here are essential in Ukraine. If you you can look up stories about the ways in which Ukrainian soldiers and escaping refugees have treated animals at a time of war and tried to preserve their lives, you begin to recognize what we have in common with them, and that is a concern and care for our neighbors, each other, and each other. And I would also only point out that it was the Estonian, I think, president just or prime minister who the other day pointed out that they, the countries immediately bordering Russia on the north, are confident that should Ukraine fall to Russia, should the U.S. pull away, Russia would not stop with Ukraine, but would continue to try to push at and recreate a Russian empire that absorbs more of its neighbors. So there are many, many reasons that we should be concerned with it. But above all, it is that sense of common values of human decency and dignity, freedom for all to worship as they will, to pursue their own personal paths as they see fit. That is, I think, what binds us with those who share those values around the world.
Yeah. Christopher Merrill, we have 2 or 3 minutes left. With the future of Ukraine hanging in the balance, literally, what are your thoughts as we look forward and consider as Askold just addressed, what is at stake?
Well, what Askold said is exactly what I think about these issues, and I would just simply add one thing, and that is that when we think about the sheer amount of money we're talking about in this Senate bill, and I very much hope that our representatives push the Speaker of the House to have an up-and-down vote on it, I'm mindful of the fact that that money is actually going to the Pentagon to buy arms that are almost all produced in the United States, including in Iowa. So the money that's going, that one side of the argument might say is going to Ukraine, it's American money going to American companies and American employees in order to bolster the Ukrainian defenses. And it's important to remember that for just a pittance of money, given the trillions of dollars that we have devoted to military spending over the years to stave off an invasion from the Soviet Union, we've managed to destroy a considerable chunk of the Russian armed forces without losing a single American life. That's something that we need to keep in mind going forward. And so I'm hoping that large consensus in the middle that we need to defend the values of civilization, defend democracy, will win out, and that the money will go forward, and the Ukrainian people will continue to fight to preserve that understanding of what it means to be a human being.
Oksana, in the final minute or so, what thoughts do you want to leave us with? Something that has been unsaid up to this moment, this hour.
I think Askold and Chris pretty much summed it up, and I really like what they mentioned about the values, that this is really important, and I myself support some friends who actually save animals that have suffered because of this war. I just want people to not forget us and to keep supporting us, because this is essentially support of democracy as a world institution.
Chris, I want to circle back to a reading event. If people would like to meet you, hear you read from your latest work, On the Road to Lviv, they can do so February 27th at Prairie Lights in downtown Iowa City. You'll be giving a reading there with writer Christopher Bolin. And war is a theme, I understand, that ties yours and his work together for this reading.
Exactly. And it gives us a chance to address in person what the consequences of war can be for all involved, whether they are on the front in Ukraine or in the cities under shell fire, or representing and hoping that the rest of the world will come along. We're all in this together, whether we know it or not.
Christopher Merrill joining us today from Mexico. Of course, he's director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program. Chris, we look forward to having you back here in Iowa. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
And thanks, indeed, heartfelt thanks to Oksana Lutsishina and Askold Melnicek. And thank you for your views as well.
Thank you so much, Ben, for taking the time to speak with us and for supporting this issue.
Thank
Oksana,
you so
thank you.
Thank
Bye
you,
now.
Ben. Bye.
Tomorrow it's a Politics Wednesday, and we will indeed talk about the vote that took place early this morning. U.S. Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley breaking with their party, voting for that aid, not only for Ukraine, but also Israel and Taiwan. Our analysts tomorrow, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Karen Kodrowski of Iowa State University. Today's River to River, produced by Kate Perez and Caitlin Troutman, with help from Samantha McIntosh. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.